The Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello, and welcome back to The Commentary Track. I'm your host, Frank Thompson, who only wants to enter his house justified. Today is a real thrill for me. My guest is L.Q. Jones, one of the great actors, terrific director. He worked with one of my cinematic idols, Sam Peckinpah, on many occasions, including in what I contend is one of the two or three greatest films anybody ever made, The Wild Bunch. He was also in, of course, The Ballad of Cable Hogue, Ride the High Country, Noon Wine, the great TV production that Peckinpah did. Worked with Raoul Walsh, worked with Bud Bedeker, Anthony Mann, Martin Scorsese. He has seen it all and done it all and directed himself a classic science fiction film called A Boy and His Dog. And even calling it a science fiction film, I think, kind of does it a disservice because it's a film that really is not like any other film. What L.Q. Jones is, in addition to being a great actor, is a great talker. And I had one of the most enjoyable afternoons of my life sitting in his office talking over his career. And we stayed there so long that I am splitting this into two parts. It went well over 2 hours, and even after editing a little bit, it will be a good solid hour with LQ in each episode. The first one is terrific. He talks a whole lot about his first film and how he changed his name to LQ Jones. You know, that's not the name he was born with. He was born Justice Ellis McQueen, which is a great name, Justice McQueen. But his character in his first film with Raoul Walsh was named LQ Jones, and I asked him about that. As a matter of fact, that's how we open the conversation. But we talk about a whole lot more, of course, Peckinpah and Strother Martin and all the other great characters that he has encountered over his great career. And next week, we'll continue with more Peckinpah talk, a lot more on The Wild Bunch, and a whole lot on A Boy and His Dog, which he is readying for its second re-release. And this will give us all a great chance to see it in the theaters once again. He's had it digitally remastered, and it looks better than ever. And if you've never seen it, I heartily encourage you to go see it. It's terrific. I'll keep you posted on when it's actually ready to go into theaters, and it's coming out on Blu-ray and all that, and it's a terrific thing. But this week, we'll start off with how his career got started. And tells me a lot of stories that I never heard before, and I was just in hog heaven throughout the entire conversation, and hope you will be too. So, I'll see you on the other side. You know, I'm going to ask you some things that many people have asked you before, so bear with me.
That's shocking.
Yeah. Right. But I'm always interested when a person takes the name of a character as his own, and your real name was a darn good name.
People think I'm nuts for changing it, but it was just one of those things. It seemed to be the end thing at the moment. It also was fun for me in that I could work in the business and not get it confused with my personal life because the name was different and people didn't make the connection.
Yeah.
And, of course, like everybody else, labor in the vineyard for a while before anybody knows you're here. I really can't make that statement because I went to work within, 2 days after I got here with probably more film than anybody got in their first 3 or 4 years.
Wow, yeah.
I'm just lucky because of Raoul. But it was a weird combination of Fess Parker, Raoul, and just that things work out. It's rather strange.
Now, what did Fess have to do with it?
I'm sorry?
What did Fess have to do with it?
Well, Fess, I was out visiting Fess, in effect. excuse me. And Fess was a friend of Bert's. And it was one of those weird things. When Fess had talked about it before, I was in Nicaragua. We had bought a ranch in Nicaragua, and I was running that, and I bumped into Fess at a Christmas party in Austin, where I was living before I went down to Nicaragua. Fess and I were roommates, had been for a number of years at the University of Texas. And I got a letter from Fess. I was in Nicaragua. He sent me the book, Battle Cry. And he said, hey, you ought to do this part. Well, I'm down in Nicaragua. Who's going to be shooting pictures in Nicaragua? For Christ's sakes. But it's one of those things. It turned out I was doing something else. I said, what the heck? I'll go do that. And when I got here, excuse me, caught a little early cold here. Fess said, you got to go see him at Warner's. Fess was already signed up to do the picture, Battle Cry. And he said, if you want to hear this, fine. If you don't, tell me.
I do indeed.
For goodness sakes. So he said, look, why don't you talk to him about doing the picture? What the hell am I going to talk to about doing the picture? Anyway, he said, let me show you. So he drew me a map on the back of a shirt stuffing that came back from the laundry. And he said, there you are. That'll get you there. Well, okay, so I follow that map, and I go out. And then things start to break your way. Either they do or they don't. At that point in time, it was over. The gate was over, and there was one man, one guard at the gate. He checked people in, and he checked them out. Well, that's going to be the end of my foray into Warner Brothers. Mm-hmm. Except as I got up to the gate, a little blonde with the tightest sweater you have ever seen in your life was going out. Guess where the guy's eyes were? He weren't looking at me. So he pushed the in button, and I went on in. Well, I haven't seen anything. Now, I knew, following my map, how to get to Hoyt Bauer's office. Hoyt was casting or helping. Solly was the main one, but Hoyt was helping. You know who I'm talking about?
Sure.
The two? Okay. Now, luck kicks in again, because Kathy is Hoyt's secretary. And if you didn't have an appointment with Hoyt, if you were King Kong, you wouldn't be allowed in the office. She's down in the hall getting a cup of coffee for him. I walk in. He's on the phone. And so, being timid and shy, I walked in and sat down in his office right across from him, and Wade Lee got through. And he wanted to know what the hell I was doing there. And I told him how lucky he was I was here to play the part of L.Q. Jones. Well, after he threw up a couple of times, we started to talk a little bit, and he said, look, I'm really busy. Call me back this afternoon. Okay, so I left. Well, we laughed and giggled at Fess's. John Lupton was there. Rice was there. And they all lived together. So he said, when you call him back? I said, I'm not going to call him back. He said, what are you talking about? Well, we're both from Texas, Fess and I. And I said, you see a guy at 10 or 10:30 in the morning, and he tells you to call him back at 1. He's trying to be very nice and saying, bugger off, don't bother me. And he said, no. Call him. If he didn't want you to call him, he wouldn't tell you to. What? Okay. So I called back. And they transferred me. Kathy transferred me right away. And White said, look, kid, I think it's nice. It's fun. But we've already tested 250 people for the part. All pros. We all know what they can do. Thank you. Like I said, it was fun, but it's just not going to work. I said, fine. Thank you. I hung up. And as I said, wait a minute, I didn't even tell him what I thought I could do. Anyway, so I called him right back. And I said, listen, you don't need. He said, for Christ's sakes, get off the phone. Give me a break. Come out. We'll talk about it. So I went back out. And we talked for a few minutes, and he said, look, this is not going to work. But I can see you're not going to just leave peacefully. So I'm going to let you talk to Solly Biano. Solly was head of casting at that time. So I went across the hall and talked to Solly. Solly spent 15 or 20 minutes telling me why I could not possibly be in the picture. That was the end of it. He was asking, telling me to leave. The phone rings. He picks it up. It's Raoul Walsh on the phone. They were talking about something else. And so Solly told him about me. And were you ever around Raoul? Ever?
No, no.
Okay. His voice carried from his years on the stage. And he said, look, send his ass up and I'll throw him out. So Solly and I went up to Raoul's office. And Solly went inside and I stayed out with the secretary. And he was inside for 2 or 3, 4 minutes. And she said, you can go in now. Well, I walked through the door and here at his desk is Raoul. He's got a dirty handkerchief shoved into his eye socket where an eye used to be.
Sure.
And he's sucking on the other end of it.
Nice.
And he's staring at me. And I'm looking back at him, and neither one of us say anything. I wasn't about to say anything, and I stood and he sat for maybe, literally, a minute and a half. Nothing was said. And finally he said, how tall are you, kid? Well, in the book, LQ almost didn't get in the service because he was too short. I think he was 5'7", mm-hmm. which is the very bottom of the Marines at that time,
sure,
for height. So I said, I'm, 5'7", 5'8", and he said, you're a goddamn liar. You're 6 feet tall. You got me. right. Can you say lots of words? I said, yeah, no, I think so. And he said, fine. Turned to Solly and said, give him a test. Well, Solly gave me the test, and I took it home, and Fess and I looked at it, and he said, that's terrible. So he called up Bert Kennedy, who was a friend of his, and told him what the problem was. And Bert said, look, bring out the script. So he did, and Bert looked at it and said, yeah, it's terrible. So I said, look, LQ, Mac, as a matter of fact, was my real name, I'm going to redo this. Give me a little while. So we waited an hour or two while he rewrote it, and then we worked on it for an hour or two, he and Fess and me, with visits from his wife and their dogs, because they raised toy poodles. Mm. Anyway, so when I got ready to leave, he said, look, I'm tickled death to help. And I was thanking him. He said, glad to do it. But you got to remember one thing. You must never, ever tell anybody that I rewrote the test scene because I'm in the guild, and that's illegal for me to do this. So just don't tell anybody. Okay. So I got up, did the test. Actually, the next morning, I went in and I asked Mr. Walsh if I could change it to what I had written. And he said, sure, I don't give a shit. Fine, kid, okay. So we did the test, and that was the end of it. And I said, it was fun. Everybody didn't get to do this. So it was worth the time. And I found out later that they had the meeting with Mr. Warner, Steve Trilling, do you know the name?
Mm-hmm.
Who was actually running the studio. Mr. Warner took the bows and gave the speeches. Steve ran it. And Raoul were discussing what they're going to do. Now, the picture is going to start shooting in Vieques. Do you know where that is?
No.
The Caribbean.
Huh.
That's where the Marines do their summer thing, their invasion, all the rest of the stuff.
Sure.
So they're going to be 25 or 30,000. Troops there. So that's where they're going to shoot it. And so they were going through and they got to the part of LQ Jones. And they said, whom are we going to use? And Raoul said he'd like me to do it. And he said, look, Raoul, give us a break here. We understand you're trying to help the kid, but you're going to be 5,000 miles away. You don't know what the guy can do. What if he gets there and screws everything up? You're going to be down for 2 or 3 days waiting for us to get somebody on the plane to get there to help you. So, look, why don't we do this? Cast one of the 250 people we've already tested. We know we've got film on them. We know what they can do. When you get back, bring the kid in, give him a day's work on some pickup stuff, and everybody's happy. And Ral, for some reason, only when you know Ral, I guess, said either the kid does the part or you can get another director. Well, they're not going to tell Ral.
No.
You know, Ral kept him alive for about 7 or 8 years. Who was the other that was so good at Warner's?
Michael Curtiz?
Mike Curtiz. He and Mike literally kept the doors open for 7 or 8 years. So, okay, I'm going. Now, I almost got in trouble because the day I got here, I didn't have any money, and a friend of Fess's was the head usher at CBS. So he said, listen, we can pick you up some pocket money. So I went to work that night as an usher. I think I was going to make, what was it, $18 for the day, something like that. Somebody saw me. I was ushering at the Red Skelton show. And somebody saw it and told Solly. And that was going to be into that because I told him I'd come up from Nicaragua. And they said, to hell with it. We don't care. And off we went. So now we get in Vieques. And the first day, Ral barely lets me see the camera. I'm off someplace else. I'm made up. I'm in wardrobe. And he wraps it for the day. Russ, who's the AD, Russ Saunders, came over and said, look, Mr. Walsh, I'd like to see you again. Okay. So I go over and Ral says, you know, we're supposed to do this scene. It's in the thing in the landing barge. I said, I don't like what it is. But I like what you wrote for me. Rewrite this scene. We're going to shoot it tomorrow.
No problem, huh?
Well, no. There was a slight problem. I couldn't reach Bert. There's no way I could reach him. I can't tell him anyway. So I rewrite the scene. Now, I've never seen a motion picture script before. Literally. Just the test thing. We show up the next morning. I've given it to Ral. He has it mimeoed and given to the actors in the shot. Van Heflin, who I think had an Oscar by that time. James Whitmore, who I think was nominated for it. Fess was there. We had Aldo Ray was there. And as only Ral can do, he gave him the script and he said, look, the kid we got here doesn't like the script that we're gonna shoot, so he rewrote it. Let's see what we can do with it. Well, we shot it. Ended up in the picture. As it turned out, I wrote maybe 20% of Battle Cry.
Wow. I had no idea of this.
Nobody else does either. None of their business. Because Ral loved to work, truly loved pictures. He had more fun shooting, I think, than any person I've ever known. But he'd work all day. We'd go to work, we'd go in at 7, wardrobe, makeup, start shooting at 9. We'd wrap at maybe 7:30 or 8. Maybe 9 that night. And invariably, Ral would call, listen, kid, I don't like what we're doing tomorrow. See what you can do with it. Okay? Now, he goes home, takes a bath. He and Mary open their doors, and they're having a party. The party would last till 4:30 or 5 the next morning. Well, I'm invited to the party. So I go to the party. I leave early. 3 o'clock, I go home and rewrite the script, go to bed for maybe an hour, get up, start over again. Ral hadn't gone to bed. He's partying, and we shoot the stuff that I've written for him. 90% of the stuff that I wrote, he shot. He just liked it, you know. So you get used to it. And, of course, Mary, the lady he was married to, was a darling lady. And knew how to handle him, kept him working. He just needed to be let alone to work, but see to it that he got some sleep, maybe 2 hours a night. that was about it. And we went that way for 4 months.
Wow.
It's, you don't do it for one day or a week.
No.
So that's how I got into picture business. And with that name, oh, when we got through shooting, I had more film practically than anybody in the picture, which made me vastly popular with the cast.
I can imagine.
Right, because he was taking their part and giving them to me. And I can't say no, for Christ's sake. I'm doing what he gives me.
Actors love to share.
Well, but they understood what was happening. They didn't know it wasn't my fault. I wouldn't do anything. When we got through, we were back here. And Ralph said, look, Ed, I kind of like what you do. I want to put you under personal contract. The last one he had put under personal contract was Rock Hudson, I think. So it would have been great for me.
That worked out okay.
Yeah, but the studio said, look, Q, we like what you're doing. You need an agent. So they had gotten me an agent. And I told Ralph that, but I said, I can, after 90 days, I can get rid of him. He said, no, don't worry about it. We'll work together. So I missed that opportunity, but it would have been great, great sport. And you learn something working with Ralph. I had, 120 directors on the picture. On the set, they'd say, stand over here. And, of course, during the lighting and stuff, I'd wander around. And the DP would say, look, kid, you want to look like Step and Fetch It? Well, no, not just fine. This is why I gave you this key light. I want you to do stuff. So he's told me exactly what I need to know. The sound man, now listen, kid, why are you doing that? I can't hear you. You don't want to be heard? I'll hold placards up for you. We can't do it. And so every one of them, the grips were telling me what I could do. And I found very early, the people in the business, the big people in the business, are the best going. It's the little ones you have to worry about. The big ones do anything in the world to help you.
Well, that sounded like you got a film school education all in one picture.
It would have taken, if I had gone to school, I would have learned 1/10 as much, and it would have taken me 3 or 4 years. Instead, in 4 months, I had this. And they didn't let up. Because you have, the first thing you learn in the business is to listen. If you want to be very bright, just shut up and listen. Most people will tell you what they want. And if they can't tell you, they'll tell you enough different things so that you can figure out actually what they want. Raul was very direct. What is it? I have done, or so they tell me, 114 pictures, I think, and something between 400 and 500 television shows.
So you've just been pretty lazy all your life.
Right, huh? Yeah. Right, just laid back. You don't find many people like Raul. First off, most directors watch what you're doing once they've told you what they want. Raul was very specific in generalities, if that makes any sense. He didn't tell you exactly where to stand, exactly how to move, but you could filter out what he was saying, what his camera was going to be doing. Now, he got everybody set. We did the lighting, the sound man, because remember in those days, the camera must have weighed, 300 pounds.
Sure.
The boom for the sound man probably weighed 85 or 90 pounds. So he just didn't, on the spur of the moment, make changes. But you learned how to anticipate the problems. And a director will normally watch to see that you're in the right position. Raul would set you up, get it set if he thought you needed to know for the picture, where to stand, roughly when to move. When everything's ready, he'd call action. Now he's rolling cigarettes. He rolled Bull Durham cigarettes 24 hours a day if he were up. You could always spot his chair because there was a ring around it of Bull Durham where he had spilled it, and matches. It took him a gopher match package, which is what, 20?
Mm-hmm.
20 lights, to get one cigarette all the way through to the end. Nevertheless, he would do it, and then he turned his back and walked away. He might be 5 inches, he might be 50 feet behind where he was when he called action, and he would not look at what you were doing. And God help you if you fail to hit your mark. And he did it all by this.
Wow.
He knew where you should be, and that's what he was. He already knew what it looked like. It was being done the way he wanted it done. The cameraman's going to tell him if it's not quite right the way he set it up. He'll know that. But he wanted to hear the way the scene was being played. And that's what he did.
Wow.
And God help you, like I say, if you A, did not hit your marks, and B, you stopped without his saying cut.
That's interesting because so many of these guys who started as silent directors like he did, the picture was much more important than the words.
That's right.
Interesting.
But not to him. Of course, you got to remember, he's an actor.
Sure.
To begin with. He's a technician. He was an AD for...
Griffith.
Right, yeah, for Griffith. So he knew all sides of it. But he finally convinced himself, I think, that he knew what it was going to look like. He knew. He didn't even bother going to Rush's. He wanted to hear the sound, what we were doing. And that was it. I didn't ask him about it. I should have. But I just took it as a point of view, and that's the way the business ran. But he's the only person out of 500 and some odd directors that I had. Oh, that's not true. About 300 and some odd, because I did 2 or 3 or 4 for each director. That would do that. Scorsese, on the other hand, never looks at it, never looks at you, but he reads the monitor. He doesn't look up from the monitor. He doesn't care what you say, particularly. He's already heard that. Peckinpah fell in between. But I've never, ever worked for another director that turned his back on the shot.
You worked for a couple of other directors real early on who are great directors, and I wonder what they were like to work with. Bud Bedeker being one, Anthony Mann being one.
Right.
To look at their films, these are great, great films. What were they like as directors on the set? Let's say Bedeker first. He was
an interesting guy. Yeah, Bud's a strange character. I don't think Bud would have been a good director of A Westerns. He didn't think that way, but he could take a B-Western apart and knew exactly what it needed. He would cast it properly, and then he was always on your back to do it. A total nut. You never knew what Bud was going to do. We nearly got into a fist fight early in the game because we're in, where was it, Phoenix, shooting in old Tucson. And pardon me, we're in Tucson, shooting in old Tucson. And he and Karen, the lady that was with him, Karen Steele, you know who I'm talking about, had a falling out. And I was downstairs doing something, and Karen and I had become good chums, talkers. And she said, look, I got a little problem. I need a place to stay for the night. Hey, use mine. So I gave her my bed, and I slept out on the couch in the other room. Well, Bud didn't know that. He saw her coming out of my room.
Uh-oh.
And we got nose to nose. And I told him what I thought about him and his inabilities and the rest of the stuff. But we were great friends after that. We were going to do another picture. Actually, the last one, just before he died, something about horses. What the hell was the name of it? I've heard it. It's a great script.
And yeah, I've heard him talk about it.
They were in Europe, he and Garner.
It was in Russia or something, wasn't it? Or something like that.
I'm not sure. It was in a weird place. Leave it up to Bud. It was about horses and circuses.
Yeah.
And he liked them both, and I liked both of them. So they had called and asked if I'd come over for breakfast, and about 4 or 5 of us showed up we talked about it, and then Bud and Jimmy, and it may have been Coburn. I think it was. It was also Coburn was in it. They went to Europe, wherever it was, to go over the stuff, came back, and then Bud died shortly after that. But Bud did it through the seat of his pants. He would watch it closely, and he would do this and this and this. He would challenge you to come up with other things. I was working with good actors in the piece, and you learn from them as you go through this stuff. I mean, I've worked with some of the best character people in the world.
Oh, sure you have.
You know, as well as the stars. And Bud picks all that up. He's got a super eye for his pictures. And we did Buchanan Rides Alone. Was the only one I did with him. We were going to do the other. It's not a great picture, but it's like many of Bud's pictures. It was extremely entertaining. And it was written, oddly enough, by Burt Kennedy,
sure.
who suggested to Bud that I be in the piece after yeah. he had rewritten my screenplay and I'd stolen from him.
Yeah, Kennedy wrote a lot of Bud's scripts.
I would say a good 50 or 60% yeah. of them. They saw alike. And you could see what Burt went to when he started directing.
Sure.
For me, and it's a personal thing, I like Burt as a writer better than I did as a director. And that's just my personal taste. Has nothing to do with ability. I was used to him as a writer. And so when he starts directing, we worked together, but it was I didn't really think of Burt as a director.
Yeah. I watched him direct a part of a film. It was a TV movie, an Alamo film.
Oh, yeah.
And he didn't seem that interested in it, to tell you the truth.
No, he was more interested in how it was yeah. written.
Yeah.
He would take it and work it around and make it better. And then, you know, you go on, is there a better, or was there ever a better director than Ford?
No.
It's hard to say. But people kept, you remember, kept pestering him, how do you do all this wonderful work? And if you remember, finally, he said what he thought was the truth was, he says, you buy a good script, you hire good actors, and you get the hell out of the way. And Burt,
that's good advice.
You bet. Perfect. And first, you got to find good actors and good sure. people. But Burt felt the same way. And look at his stuff. How can you, what are you going to tell Jack Elam? Right?
Sure. He knows what to do.
You bet. Or Denver. Or Warren, for Christ's sakes. So he could then forget about us and deal with the leads. And what are you going to tell Jimmy Garner? You know?
Well, that's the case with a lot of those guys. They would have their stock company of actors. Ford certainly did. And even Peckinpah had a group of people that he used again and again and again.
You bet.
And
you don't. They didn't do it. People think. Well, I don't know what people think. Sam did it because. You ever around Peckinpah?
Never met him.
Well, everybody has good things happen to them. You had good things happen to you.
I have a feeling, as much as I admire him, I have a feeling he's not somebody I would have wanted to be in the room with very much.
No,
maybe I'm wrong.
No. Well, it depends on what your outlook was. Well, put him in perspective in one regard. We were doing The Ballad of Cable Hogue. Remember? Jason Robards.
Do I remember? One of my favorites.
Jason, to me, was the best actor in our business at that period. Wasn't the biggest star. Wasn't the highest paid. He was the best actor. Anyway, he's using Jason. Stella, who never really did anything. She was very entertaining. She was very pretty. She had never worked at her part like Sam had her work on this. The guy from England, David Warner.
David Warner, yeah.
Marvelous. I can say that I was supposed to do that part.
Oh, yeah.
But he was marvelous. Nobody would have been as good as he was in it. Anyway, Sam was really a ball of nerves because we fell way behind. We were, and it was supposed to be a small budget. And we were 2 weeks, 3 weeks behind. Part of it, the main reason was weather. It rained 24 hours a day. Or if it didn't rain, it's because we were off sleeping. So we'd change our sleeping time from night to day, and then it would rain while it was supposed to be dry, and we couldn't get, so Sam was that way. He's not an easy man to get along with to begin with, although I've made, 9, 10, 11 pictures with him. We were going to do 3 or 4 more. It's about, you've seen the picture, so it's about our trying to dispose of Jason.
Yes.
By putting him in the desert. We can't get anything to drink, so he's going to die. Strother and I leave him there. Well, the night before we were to shoot, the biggest rainstorm I think that part of the country had ever seen happened. It washed out like 8 or 9 bridges, and we are standing looking at Lake Peckinpah that is maybe only an inch deep, but it may be 2,000 square miles where we're supposed to be shooting. And Jason and Sam were there, and Strother and I were there. We'd come out early, and we're looking out over this vast ocean. Sam is not a happy camper. The bus pulls up. The crew gets off. Most of them get off. And the makeup man who's done several pictures with Sam stops, pats him on the back, and says, "Don't you worry, Sam. We'll get you through this." Sam said, "Thank you very much." The makeup man walked off. Sam turned to the AD and said, "Put his ass on the bus." He didn't even get to get his brushes unpacked. He's fired. We fired on that picture, I would say, something between 60% and 70% of the crew. He fired me 5 times in one day, but he couldn't get rid of me because I'm in the picture. It got so bad that we kept a limousine on the set to take the people fired that day back to pack their clothes and to the airport so they could return home. We kept another limousine at the airport to pick up the incoming crew to take them to work so Sam wouldn't have to shut down for no crew. A sort of a tough man to work for.
I can imagine.
Is impossible. But the only way you live with Sam, we hit that problem with Warren Oates, Ben Johnson, and myself in Major Dundee. We did something that Sam did not tell us to do. And we were right. It's the only thing that saved us. But we did things. We did some stuff. Have you seen the picture?
Oh, sure.
Okay, you know the big battle is in the water.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They had built a railroad track for, I don't know, a couple of, maybe 100 feet, underwater with the observatory on it with the camera. So Sam could go back and forth in the water and film the shooting, the fighting. Well, we, the three of us, saw some, and we chased some people way down the river, which we weren't supposed to do. And we started back, and we got close enough. When Sam really got mad, he started talking like this, so you had to lean forward to listen to him. But he's saying, you sorry people. You'll never work in this business again. You have no talent. I don't know why I put up with it. And he went on that way for about 3 or 4 or 5 minutes. And we're riding up. And I finally got so mad, I rode right up to the tower. And I had to stand on my horse to be able to reach up high enough to get hold of the stuff around it to keep him from falling out. I was climbing over the top because I'm going to stomp his ass. And I told him, "Peckinpah, you ain't got enough talent, direct me to the men's room. And it got very, very quiet. Very quiet. While Sam decided. And then he said, and we got along fine. But if you let Sam get on your case, you were screwed. He buffaloed William Holden, Bill Holden, Bob Ryan, Charlton Heston, Dick Harris. Didn't make him any difference. But I learned early in the game, you had to stay on his case. We're back to Cable Hoag. We're doing Cable Hoag. And it was just Strother, Jason, and myself. And we've already done the full shot, long shot. And we are doing, we've done my close-up, and we're swung around to do Jason's. So we're all sitting there around. And you know who Lucian Ballard was?
Oh, sure.
Cameron. Okay, Lucian's our cameraman. Lucian wouldn't even allow Sam to sit on the camera. For a long time, it took him to. I had free rein. I could sit on it. I could operate. For some reasons, we got along. And so we're doing that shot. We're doing the reverse for Jason, and I'm on the camera seat. I'm here. Strother's over here about 8 or 10 feet. Sam's over here about 15 or 20. We do the shot. Jason's close up. Sam said cut, and we're all sitting there waiting. And Jason, without thinking, he meant no disrespect, for Christ's sake, since I'm like from here to you, from him. He said, what do you think, Q? I said, listen, Jason, if I were you, I'd start writing my acceptance speech. And then we realized what we'd done, so we shut up. Nobody moved. Nobody said anything. It was about 2 or 3 minutes. And Sam said, LQ, do you really mind if I direct my own picture? I said, no, Sam, you know, you need a little help, but go ahead. And we got along fine. But, again, like you said, you're not sure you'd enjoy him. Chuck Heston almost killed him. I mean, literally almost killed him. Reflective. He was sitting up on his horse, and he had the big saber. And as only Sam can do, he had the real saber. Well, the real saber, A, is a weapon. B, it's very heavy. And he made Chuck so mad that he jerked the thing up. He was going to slice him in two. And he would have. I mean, he would have decapitated him the way he was going. And he got control, and he realized, wait. And he backed off. But Sam could be very difficult to work for.
I spent an evening with Max Evans in a bar room in Albuquerque one time. And everything he told me about Sam was funny and horrifying.
It's both.
Yeah.
I did a thing for old Max here about 3 or 4 months ago. He was getting another award and stuff. And he asked, and I went down to Albuquerque to do some of the introduction for him. You know he's one of the great writers of all time.
He sure is.
Yeah. And he's still the same, although he's in very rocky condition right now.
That's what
but
I hear.
He and Sam had a 10 or 12 year fight. Every time they got together, they'd punch each other out. The only thing that saved them is normally when they did, they were both drunk and nobody got hurt. But when you talk about Max, I don't know what he was on the stand with the governor doing something, and the governor got derogatory about Indians. Max stood up, walked over, sucker punched him, knocked him off of the thing, and went back and sat down. That's Max.
That's Max.
Right. You don't want to get Max upset. I love him. I've tried to do 3 of his pictures. I've got 3 of his books. And I finally told him, Max, much I hate to say this, your Rounders was okay. It was okay because of the actors. It was not a good piece. you've got to learn, and it's hard to do, but no one else can write what you write a book of. You cannot write, because you need your words to say what you're conveying. Sure. We were going to do Bobby Jack Smith, You Dirty Coward. Mm-hmm. We were going to do My Partner, and we were going to do the thing that I'm going to do if it Hair Lips the Governor, and that's The One-Eyed Sky.
Oh, nice.
You know The One-Eyed Sky?
Sure, I've read them all, yeah.
I don't know how my cameraman and I, we've talked about it. We figure it'll take us about 3 or 4 years to do it, because we're going to use animals. We're not going to go to animation. It's one of the most brilliant pieces ever written.
He's a remarkable writer.
You bet.
And he had great Cable Hogue stories, because he was around on that.
Well, it's really the only thing that made it happen is Slim Pickens was able to sort of work between them, because Max and Slim were up on in the booth.
Mm-hmm.
Max was the shotgun, and Slim was the driver. Well, people don't realize, but Slim was a superb clown in rodeos.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. He saved a lot of people. He also is one of three men that I know that were still alive. He would cape a Brahma. Have you ever seen that?
No.
Well, you're an insane to do it. Because the brave
insane.
Bulls will keep following the cape. The Brahma's too smart. He'll follow the cape a couple of times. He'll say, wait a minute. This ain't the way it's working. So you get him to you, and you move him left, and he hooks right, and you're in the morgue.
Wow.
Bud Bedeker, as a matter of fact, did it. Bud learned very quickly. He didn't have enough brains or symmetry to do it. He got out. There were about six people that did it professionally, and five of them were dead. Slim was about the only one left.
Wow.
But he could keep... Max and Sam loved each other. They would have died if they hadn't have had each other. But they just couldn't get along in the same room. It was classic. Anyway.
Before we start talking about Peckinpah some more, because I want to talk about Peckinpah, but I also want to talk about Strother Martin, who I love.
Who wouldn't? Right, okay.
And... I've been told that you guys were friends even beyond the pictures. And,
oh, good heavens, yeah.
And is that why Sam would tend to team you up, or is that just a coincidence?
I don't know why, but you look at it, and there were much bigger parts. Like, I worked with Sam, I think, in 9 pictures, 9 or 10. We were going to do 2 or 3 others. And by the time we were through, if it had gone on, we would have done about 16 or 17 pieces together. If one of us had not killed the other. I was like Max with him. Strother is, what do you say about Strother? Everybody thinks, not everybody, a lot of the people who don't study our business that well think that he was the only one, Strother, was the only one doing the things he did. He was superb at them. But look at it. Remember Paul Guilfoyle?
Sure.
Paul started it. And then he came down from that. Now, the guy who worked with John Wayne, Paul Fix.
Oh, Paul Fix, sure.
Picked up where Paul left off. And moved that character a little bit farther. And then along came Cookie, Elijah Cook Jr., and took it even further. And then Strother came along and took everything they had done and added another dimension to it. Nobody was like Strother. But you will notice that Strother and I would almost invariably do not the major parts. And we finally figured out, much to our chagrin, that Sam he had a stock company to speak of. But the stars, no, although we work with them a bit. But he could rely on Strother and I to take what to him were minor parts and build them up. Most people, for some reason, remember Strother and myself from the Wild Bunch more than they do Bill Holden or Bob Bryant. And that's BS, because they're marvelous. But
I once read a critic who called them, your characters, the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of white trash.
Oh, yeah. We worked together because we liked it. We were working on the Wild Bunch, and we'd started a week before Bill Holden even came on the picture. And we're doing the scene where we fight over who killed the people.
Mm-hmm.
And just before we rehearsed it, we got everybody set up. Took us an hour and a half, 2 hours to place everybody. And so now we're going to do it. Bill Holden shows up. Now, I knew Bill pretty well because we'd already done a picture, Toward the Unknown. And we worked together for 2.5-3 months. So I knew him, and I was used to him. But he came and just got there before we shot. So Sam, had him bring a chair right next to him by the camera. And here we went. We did that shot all the way. We went all the way through to the end. As soon as he said cut, Bill jumped up and started running to his car. And Sam said, wait, what are you doing? And Bill says, turned around and pointed to Strother and me. He says, is that the way you're going to shoot the rest of the picture? And Sam said, yeah. Bill said, I'm going back and start studying my script. Because you watch Strother, you know, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
What can I tell you about Strother? You made me a better ask because he's a true friend, a genius at what he did. He was petrified when he worked, especially around Sam. Hmm. Petrified of Sam. But who wasn't? Bill Holden was. Bob Ryan was. R.G. Armstrong was. Slim was. So it goes with the territory. But we loved to work together because what we did had very little bit to do with what was written in the script, except where we knew Sam wanted to go.
Yeah.
Because you're asking about the people that work with him all the time, the stock company. One of the reasons he had you there is that, unlike any director, unlike Raoul Walsh or any director that I've worked with, Sam never told you what to do. He talked in generalities. And you better pay attention. Now, if you're Bill Holden and it's your scene, or you're Bob and it's your scene, he may tell you a few things, not much. But Sam depended on your knowing. Now, mind you, he's been working on that script for a year. He's seen that scene in his mind's eye 1,000 times. But he doesn't tell you what to do. You better figure out from what you know about Sam and what you're used to his shooting where you better be. That's why I told you that thing with Ben Johnson, Warren Oates, and myself, because he didn't see it that way. And he wasn't sure that was going to work at all. But that's the way he worked. Well, that's hellaciously hard, especially if you don't know Sam. So he tended to keep the people around him. You better know what you were doing and be able to deliver. You notice the people he had on his stock company, like the same people that Mr. Ford had, were damn good actors.
Sure.
They didn't need anything. They could do their own. And he expected you to feed the story. So Sam is, what do I say, a detail man. I'll tell you how dear that is, but that's what he worried with. He then left it up to you to understand what he had written in the script. although he didn't write the script, he rewrote every one of them. A better writer than he was director. So he did it, but you damn sure better figure it out properly or you're up a creek. Strother did that, but less, I think, than any, probably less than anybody else. But he knew enough, and Strother was so good that Sam let him go.
Yeah, there are, as you look at all of Peckinpah's films, as I've seen everything he ever did, there seem to be mannerisms and not only camera angles, but the way the actors move and talk that seem to be consistent. So I always get the idea that he was a lot more hands-on in saying, do it like this or do it like that.
He's hands-on. Sam's great talent was, A, his casting. Look at the Wild Bunch. Bill Holden? Now, you can understand Bob Ryan. Bob was so good, but he did that sort of thing. Eddie? You're going to have, well, Eddie did the same thing in The Hunchback of Notre Dame. He just did it as a pretty man.
Sure.
As an older man, he's going to do what he wants to do. But look at the cast in The Bunch. Albert Dekker? What are you going to tell Albert?
He's been around.
He made 3 million pictures.
Yeah.
He's also one of the weirdest people. I loved him. We had great fun working together because he was a consummate professional. He knew what, when, he loved to tell dirty jokes. Each one at least 300 years old. If it wasn't, he didn't tell you. But he was fun to watch him do it. He showed up with a little girl that was maybe 40 years younger than he was. Introduced her as his wife, and he was stopping off to do the picture because he was only on it for about 2 or 3 weeks, Albert. He was on his way to a .4 country where he was going to perform operations. And the .4 people had invaded that he be there to help them. Well, when we finished the picture, we found out, hey, of course she wasn't his wife. I think he had picked her up at El Paso or something on his way down. B, the .4 people had never heard of him. He couldn't apply a Band-Aid. But that's the way Albert was. And he's a good friend in that he's warm. And when he finished, which was very early, he said, listen, Q, let's not let this be one of those things where I'm going to see you, I'll call you, so forth. Let's really get together when you get back. Well, okay. Sam gave us 2 days off in the middle of shooting, which we shouldn't have had. We flew back. I was living in Camarillo, but I was by myself doing some business in L.A. that afternoon, and I looked at I'm wearing my MG. The top is down. As close as you are, there stands Albert Dekker. Well, I waved. He looked right through me. I stood up in my car because we're sitting in traffic, and I'm waving both hands. He looked right at me, no recognition whatsoever. This is at Hollywood at Highland. He paused, walked into a shoddy door, and disappeared. I picked up the paper the next morning. He had been found hung in the bathtub, you remember? How can you hang? It's impossible to hang yourself where you can stand up. The body will not accept it. It will fight to stay alive. So obviously he was killed. If you remember, they found him, I guess you'd have to say garroted, for Christ's sakes, mm-hmm. on the shower thing.
Yeah.
With obscene things written on his body. You remember?
That's what I've heard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Odd man. Good actor. Well, anybody can sit and fool us into believing he's going to be operating on people in a third world company is not too shabby.
He was playing some other roles in his real life.
He was someplace else.
Yeah. And with a little lurid story about Albert Dekker, we conclude part one of this interview with L.Q. Jones. And I hope you'll come back again next week for the rousing conclusion. We got lots more great Wild Bunch stories and Cable Hoax stories, and a lot of talk about a boy and his dog, and it's just great fun. Hope you will come back. And I hope that LQ will come back. I got about six more hours of interview in me with him, because that guy can tell a good story, and he has lived a good life, and I like him, so we will be back with him if he will put up with me once more. Before we go, I want to thank everybody involved in putting this podcast on the air. First and foremost, my wonderful announcer, Claire McCullough, who is even my more wonderful wife. Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand, who wrote the great music. James Hutchins, who designed my website, thecommentarytrack.com, and also my personal website, frankthompson.tv. I hope you'll check them both. There are books and videos of my own that are for sale there, either directly through me or through Amazon links. And I will post lots of stuff from L.Q. Jones that you can order from Amazon, many of his great movies. And whenever you do that, it will cost you not one penny extra, but we will get a little bit of kickback here. And anything we can do to help keep the podcast rolling is okay by me, so I hope that you will help me out. You can also help me out by going on iTunes and leaving a nice review. A 5-star rating would be good, and friendly words would certainly help out to bring other people to the podcast, and I hope that you will be willing to do that. We've had some very nice comments, and I hope to get lots more. So until next week, when we'll have part two of our interview with L.Q. Jones. Hope you have a good one, and don't you worry, we'll fix it in post.